Hello, everyone, and welcome to a Friends with Fantasy Benefits concept podcast. I am Chuck Anderson in the heart of Wisconsin that is getting pelted with rain and rain and more rain. And how is the weather by you, Andrew Dewhurst?
It's not too bad. We've had our fair share of rain as well. It's not atypical for us to get your weather like a day or so later. Based on our proximity, but it hasn't been too bad. It's been pretty warm on the weekend, and we did also have some rain.
Yeah, that happens. I can be reached on Twitter at Just Chucking It, and Andrew, your Twitter handle is?
At Andrew K. Dewhurst.
Okay, the concept this week has come into clarity because of both the pennant chase and the secondary trade deadline, which I never remember it being quite so active. So many players getting through waivers and so much activity and so much competition for people at the end of the secondary trade deadline instead of the more prevalent trade deadline, which is closer to the All-Star game itself. Do you remember the hysteria that there was this year before in the secondary trade market?
I don't usually. Usually, the waiver trades are hard to accomplish. I'm not certain what's made that so much easier this year. Maybe it's just other teams not being as willing to block those trades based from waivers and things like that.
Yeah, that appears to be something that's happened, and I do think that both the pennant chase and the secondary trade deadline has put a new twist on change of scenery guys. You sometimes see them with COS, you know, maybe a COS bump. In the present player climate, I think these players are especially important for us to take a look at because the end game in drafts for fantasy that we like to participate in are at least 14 teams or bigger. And right now we're looking at you know, the Cedric Mullins of the world. We're trying to gauge exactly what we can get out of players on the teams that are rebuilding. And it doesn't take very long till we have to really sort of assess players that are in a different environment than they've been in when they've had success in the past or when they've failed in the past. Usually they've at least failed some in the more recent past, and that is why they are going through this trade or this waiver process to landing on different teams. So the first person I want to talk about, and this isn't really to be a homer, it's just the idea that we have seldom seen a pitcher fall from grace any further than Gio Gonzalez has this year. Gio Gonzalez is now a member of the Brewers. Just yesterday, he was warming up for what appeared to be a bullpen stint. It looks like he may be going from the starter mold back to the bullpen, which he hasn't been in quite some time. He's 32 years old. He is a left-handed pitcher, and so that especially aligns him with the availability to potentially affect things from the bullpen. But he's had a heck of a run from 2015 to 2017, and right now it looks like that run has ended. Do you think we have the possibility of a change of scenery bump with Gio Gonzalez?
I don't think it's – if we see a bump on Gio Gonzalez, I don't think it's necessarily going to be change of scenery because, I mean, it's well advertised that that Miller Park is less friendly to pitchers than Nationals Park was. But I think one thing that could, if you do see a bit of a resurgence here from Gio Gonzalez, is a difference in competition. I looked at an article earlier today that noted that the Brewers have a very friendly schedule pretty much the rest of the way. I think a series against the Cubs and a series against the Cardinals, and the rest are against non-contenders. So that could play a very big factor. The biggest thing I think for Gonzalez to be effective is he's got to get his walks back down. Like, he's got a 4.32 walk per nine. That in combination with a declined K per nine isn't going to be really good for him. I would also think that does it make sense for the Brewers to acquire Gio Gonzalez to put him in the bullpen? I'm not sure that it does, because his ERA today is no different than it was in 2016 when he made 32 starts. So I think you could be looking at that player, but just something to keep in mind is if he pitches well, the Brewers have a nice path moving forward. So he could be a guy that can get you some wins at a pretty low cost.
Well, I think one of the things that's happening here is the Brewers picked up Xavier Cedeño and Gio Gonzalez at the waiver deadline. And Dan Jennings is a guy that the Brewers had picked up off of the scrap heap from the Tampa Rays, who just decided they didn't want to pay Dan Jennings. And Dan Jennings was pretty effective for a good chunk of the season, but he has been quite a bit less effective lately. They're sort of going through the process of trying to get him some appearances and get his confidence back up. So there is sort of an opening there in the left-handed relief role. I assume that they were also going to use Gio Gonzalez as a starter, but I think it may have been an insurance plan for if Zach Davies' start didn't go as well as it did yesterday. They pulled Zach Davies after five innings of being very effective and somehow still managed to win the first game of a big series with the Cubs. I think it's important to note when it comes to Gio Gonzalez that he's never been a darling of the sabermetric community. He's always walked people at a pretty high rate, and he really hasn't struck out people at the new levels of elite. He's been right around 9 Ks per 9, a little bit over 8. He was dipped below 8.5 K per 9 last year, and now he's under 8 Ks per 9 this year. So that's certainly part of what's happening. You can also look at it like he's been fairly successful as an innings eater in recent years, pitching over 175 innings each of the last three seasons. But as a generality, the sabermetric peripherals of FIP and XFIP haven't loved Gio very much over the years, and this appears to be the case now. He's also only under contract to the end of the season, so he's someone that we'll have to really take a look at where he ends up next year. And being 32 years old, having been in the major leagues since 2008, he's got 10 years under his belt. We'll have to look for signs the rest of this season to see if he really has a whole lot left in the tank. Let's talk about a player now that switched teams, and this might be for completely different reasons. I'm curious because Andrew and I haven't talked about it. What did you think about Tommy Pham moving to the Rays, and what do you think about his chances to be quite valuable here moving forward?
Tommy Pham was a player I was really interested in coming into this year. I think I drafted him in the first five rounds at TGFBI, and he's been a huge disappointment in the sense that he hasn't provided he's provided about the power I thought I'd get. He's given me about the runs I thought I'd get, but huge deficiency in RBIs from what he did last year, and only 10 steals as well is kind of dragging things down from an overall perspective. Can he catch fire for the rest of the year? Maybe. The Rays aren't completely out of it. They still have something to play for. Much like the Brewers, they also have a favorable schedule. So, I mean, if Tommy Pham's laying around on waivers for you, I think he's a guy that could be worth keeping an eye on. And as soon as you start to see him start to stack up hits in multiple in consecutive games, that I would want to jump on pretty quick if you've got the roster space, that is.
Well, I have noticed that he's running exceptionally well yet, you know, as far as running the bases, but his stolen bases are certainly down this year. He's on pace to fall well below the 25 stolen bases he had last year. It's also of note that his walk rate is down almost 3% this year, while his strikeout rate is up, which never really helps anything either. I just think his offseason was very odd because an article was published that he was disenfranchised, had felt disenfranchised by the Cardinals organization. And then mysteriously he gets traded off to an American League team, sort of in sort of a dead zone right before we got even to the first trade deadline. And he supposedly was having some trouble with his eyes, and there was some sight issues that were going on. I don't know how much of that was actually, how much of that has actually been substantiated in the numbers, because he still looks like he could be a good player. It's also important to note that he had a 368 BABIP in 2017, which was largely considered his, you know, his full breakout season, since the end of 2016 is when he first started to show some promise. And so this year his BABIP is down to 314, which still doesn't coincide with the fact that he should be hitting just 255. He's a player who runs pretty well, so on the surface, a 314 BABIP should get him into at least the 280s, one would hope. So anyway, we have a lot to watch there. I do think the Rays have a tendency to help certain people, just the environment down there, as far as fiery personalities seem to want to prove the world wrong and go to the Rays where they overachieve. You think that's an oversimplification, Andrew?
Maybe somewhat, but not one that I don't think it's that much of an oversimplification.
Yeah, I think that's generally considered one of the things about the Rays. You know, look at Sergio Romo, look at Matt Duffy, guys who have run out of chances or have not been given enough of a chance in other organizations, seem to go to Tampa and flourish. And we'll have to see if Tommy Pham is one of those guys. Now let's talk about a guy who also was traded away from the Rays. And he was traded away from the Rays when he was hurt. And in a recent game that I watched, Wilson Ramos looks like he's probably still hurt. Somewhat, anyway. He's not running very well yet at this point. His nickname is the Buffalo, which you guys know I love nicknames. And unfortunately, he runs as if he's kind of storming around like a buffalo in a slow, prodding kind of fashion. So anyway, catcher has been such a dearth. There's been nothing there this year. So what do you think the chances are that Wilson Ramos is quite valuable as a catcher the rest of this year and going forward?
I don't love the opportunity. So, I mean, he's been actually pretty decent, I think, for the Phillies since acquiring him. But the problem with Wilson Ramos is fairly consistent in that you never know how long he's going to stay healthy for. Because that's just been his career. Like, he's never played more than 122 games, which somewhat is being a catcher, and is also somewhat because he really struggles to stay healthy. In the world of catcher, do I think he's worth acquiring if your catcher is slumping? Or absolutely, if he's available to you, might be worth looking at. At the very least, you know, whether he runs well or not, he's on a contender, so they've got a reason, like, who's in a race, so they're gonna run their best lineup out every day, Philly's not the worst place to hit in the world. So, I think for the rest of this year, you have to consider that. Moving to next year, I think you take it for what it is. And I think, like, catcher in baseball leagues that aren't two catcher leagues have gone the way of, like, kickers and defense in football, where it's like, why should I jump up and grab some guy because they're all practically underperforming in the exact same manner?
It's pretty odd that catcher has actually disappointed this year, because I don't think people had very high expectations for it to begin with. But with the struggles of Gary Sanchez and the struggles of Buster Posey, we seem to be hitting a new all-time low in catcher value. I think it's pretty important to note that Wilson Ramos is hitting 307, but he's hitting 307 with a 352 BABIP. which I think is about as dramatically unsustainable a BABIP as I could imagine seeing, due to the fact that he just doesn't run well enough for that really to be, you know, a likelihood going forward. You know, and he also, most his time in Philly hasn't been unproductive in catcher terminology, you know, or in catcher, putting it in the vein of catchers. But he had 2 3-hit games when he got to Philadelphia, and since then he's only had one more multi-hit game since then. So it hasn't been super productive either. It's nothing that you can hang your hat on and say that you got some sort of exceptional playoff push for either. So it's leaving us in a spot where we have to wonder. I mean, next year we also have Wellington Castillo coming back from suspension now that I took a gamble on today. So I believe yesterday was supposed to be his first start back off his suspension. So it doesn't take a lot to have value at the catcher position, and we're going to have to take gambles like Wilson Ramos and Wellington Castillo next year. I'm in almost exclusively 2 catcher leagues, which has really turned into an absolute dumpster fire, trying to figure out how to actually acquire 2 catchers that have some value. Let's talk about a guy who's got a little bit more hype going on around him right now, and that is Tyler Glasnow. I realized that he had a good relief stint this year with the Pirates, but the Rays have been trying to use him as a starter and stretch him out. He is only 25 years old. He's a big, tall guy with big, long mechanics, 6'8", 220 pounds. What do you think about Tyler Glasnow now that he doesn't have to be looking over his shoulder? It seems like the Rays are giving him the golden ticket to becoming one of their starters.
For the rest of this year, I love it. It's a good opportunity, and this is something that the Rays do have a nice history of, is kind of turning pitchers around. You know, they've done more probably with less in the past with some of the guys they've acquired. I mean, you have to be at least somewhat impressed with, you know, 7-inning, 2-hit performance against in Cleveland. Where you get kind of mildly confused on some of these are like you want more in a 5-inning in his start before that against Kansas City. But he's got good stuff. Like, that's one thing you can't take away from him, and that's something that always keeps kind of fantasy players tantalized, is, well, he's got good stuff, so he can be good, right? Like, if he can just put it all together, he can be good. I think when you think of Glasnow, rightly or wrongly, he kind of gets put into that same mold as, like, a Randy Johnson, where it's like, it took Randy Johnson a long time to figure out the mechanics and figure out how to, you know, repeat them enough to be consistent. And Glasnow is going to have that same path ahead of him. Whereas, can anyone get him to a point where his mechanics are repeatable and consistent, so that that stuff even matters? Because if you can't find the strike zone, it doesn't matter how good your fastball or your curveball or your changeup are.
He's also going to land in a special classification, subclassification next year. It's always difficult to tell how to judge a player who's spent a lot of the season in the bullpen and then becomes a starter, because even his numbers in Tampa are going to be jaded by them only using him for 3 innings in his first start and then 4 innings in his second start. I mean, his strikeout rate is held pretty good. Until, you know, 2 of his last 3 starts, he's actually had less than a strikeout per inning. And oddly enough, the Kansas City start that you spoke of, where he didn't pitch as well as we would have hoped, he did manage to get up over a strikeout per inning pretty handily with 8 Ks in 5 innings. I doubt he's going to land in the area of being a guy who can hurt you with strikeouts next year. I certainly understand that. And I certainly understand with recently drafting a 14-team league, I mean, he was far from one of the last pitchers taken off the board when I took him. So you're going to see a market, and you're going to see people taking a shot at Tyler Glasnow next year. And I think the microscope will be on him to see exactly how his stuff will translate. I mean, you worry more about a guy who's been labeled a bullpen guy for longer than the stretch Glasnow was. I mean, Glasnow was being used as a starter all the way up until this season, and he's been on the prospect radar for 3 to 4 years minimum. I might be calling that a little bit low. I remember when Tyone and Glasnow, it was a big debate on which one of those guys was the better of the two prospects. So Tyler Glasnow is somebody who's going to get taken in almost every draft next year. I can guarantee that, even shallow leagues, because of the potential and because of, as Andrew pointed out, because of the reputation that the Tampa Rays have for rehabilitating pitchers' careers. So right now things look pretty good for the most part for Glasnow. He's really only had two starts as a Ray where he's given up more than 3 earned runs. So we have some hope for sure.
Yeah, I just asked this last question or two last questions on it. One of them, I guess, is just a thought. It's not so much a question. Like, I wonder if Glasnow became a reliever option because he was out of options. So it was a way for the Pirates to keep him on the roster instead of potentially because they might not have had another option other than to trade him. And the other is, like, how interested in Glasnow do you think he'll be going into next year, Chuck? He's a guy that I worry is going to get a pretty inflated cost if he continues to be even mildly successful the rest of this year.
Well, I think one of the things that's going to happen here is the Rays not only have done a good job of rehabbing pitchers and you know, getting their career back in order, but they've also been so experimental in how they use their starters. When I brought up Glasnow in the FWFB chat room, I got a lot of guffaws and rolling eyes because people think that, you know, he's only got two pitches and he can only go 5 innings. Well, you know, his last start doesn't look like that, but it'd take a lot longer of a sample than that to know. But I also question how much of the league is going much longer than 5 innings now to begin with. You know, it's like the Brewers are 16 games over 500, and it's quite the oddity to see them have a pitcher pitch into the 7th inning for sure. And lots of them don't make it out of the 6th inning. So they pitch 5 1/3 or 5 2/3. And the other question that I'm trying to answer from you here is, I think there was a chance that Pittsburgh thought that Glasnow could be a Josh Hader type reliever or a Chris Devensky type reliever, somebody who could work 2-3 innings in the middle of the game. And maybe they didn't execute it quite properly because the back end of their bullpen was pretty strong early on in the season when they were doing well in Pittsburgh. So maybe it was an experiment going the opposite way as well. So it's pretty difficult to diagnose right now. I do think the next month of the season is going to give us a little bit more of an idea as far as what the Rays are hoping for him. If they continue to let him go deeper into games, you'll think maybe they're trying to develop him into a front-end line starter instead of what they do with the back of their rotation. So this is going to be a fascinating case study because it comes at the idea of what a starter is from a few different angles. I think I'm more than willing to take a shot at him late. I proved that already because I got in pretty early in his stint with the Rays when I drafted him in 3-sport, which is way too earlier than even the way too early mocks, which are coming up. So I think it's going to be, I think you'll have a hard time not wanting to take gambles like this when you get to the back of the pitching field going into next year for sure. So, and right now I bet you he's owned in most leagues because he has been relatively hot and because most people in pennant races are still hoping to keep up their strikeout numbers as we get down the stretch and go for fantasy baseball titles. Now let's talk about another guy that I don't think we've ever really fully doubted his hitting ability, and that is Daniel Murphy. Daniel Murphy, the second baseman/first baseman for the Chicago Cubs now, who who came over from the Washington Nationals, who waited a little bit past the deadline and into the waiver deadline to sort of start waving the white flag. I'm happy that they didn't wave the white flag yesterday as they beat the Cardinals in a comeback game. But Daniel Murphy has had, he was really good for quite a while, and then he was great for quite a while, and then he got hurt. So where are you on Daniel Murphy going forward? I mean, I think people have to love him the rest of the year as a Cub. But how interested do you think and how high do you think he could go going forward as a second baseman?
Forward. And a lot of it's going to have to do with where what his landing spot is. Like, I would be of the opinion that for the right price, I would still be in on Daniel Murphy next year. He's played well since coming over from the Cubs. And I would guess that he's going to land with a team that is in some amount of contention next year. Because, I mean, even when you look at what he's... I mean, he's only played 68 games. But in that 68 games, he's still giving you nine home runs. He's still giving you decent counting stats and 25 runs and 35 RBIs. So I think there's still some reason to be hopeful here that, you know, if he can play another 140, 150 games that he's... and on a good team, that he's going to give you, you know, home runs in the late teens, early 20s, and provide you good counting stats, as well as still providing you with a good average, because I think he is a guy that at least I think of as kind of being a professional hitter. And those guys typically, when healthy, do still age well. So for me, I'm still willing to pay the cost a little bit on Murphy, because I think he's still fairly safe. And I also don't expect you to have to pay a really high cost to get him onto your team next year because of the injuries this year.
Well, there's probably enough youngsters and enough breakouts at second base, including, you know, Ozzie Albies, who finally hit another home run yesterday, including Luis Urias, who was called up recently by the Padres, that I think you're going to see Daniel Murphy last towards the bottom of the sort of the 7 to 10 range in second baseman for sure. And since his cost has been higher than that in recent years, I see what you're saying as far as him being a potential draft value next year. And he's always been known as a player who's had elite contact skills. I mean, he puts the bat to the ball well, and he generally barrels it up. And that is something that I think is helping him when the wind blows out at Wrigley Field. It does stink that the Brewers have to face him on a regular basis. He's done a good amount of damage in the games against Milwaukee already. So, and there was a bit of an outrage that he got through the waiver process, which, you know, I've sort of given Matt Thompson and the Cardinal folk at FWFB a hard time about being so into the what I consider to be the skeleton of Josh Donaldson. But I do understand them thinking that they should have landed Daniel Murphy as a hitter from the left side instead of landing Matt Adams, who offers quite a bit less versatility in the field and is not quite established as a hitter the way that Daniel Murphy is.
Yeah, the fact that he managed to get through to the Cubs is pretty astounding to me. I guess the Brewers and the Cardinals must have both thought that Murphy, that the Cubs wouldn't have interest in him. Like, I just don't understand why they wouldn't have blocked that.
My perspective on why the Brewers didn't, quote-unquote, block it is partially because I think they felt like, as a team, they were so overloaded in the middle infield already. I mean, Travis Shaw is all the way up to 24 games at second, so I did my happy dance when he got to 20 because I really wanted that eligibility in three sport. But they're using a third baseman at second base, and they also obviously have Hernan Perez and the more likely candidate to man second base next year in Jonathan Scope. So I think that was part of it for the Brewers for sure. And it may have been sort of a penny-pinching issue as well. It went over a lot worse with the Cardinal fans because the Cardinals are struggling with Jed Jorko and Colton Wong at second base and third base, respectively. So anyway, let's move on to a guy who I found really fascinating that moved And I'm surprised that the Brewers didn't acquire this guy more so than I am about Daniel Murphy. And that's one Kevin Gausman. Kevin Gausman, talented. Always, everyone always talked about what good stuff he had when he was in Baltimore. But then again, that's in Baltimore. But he has a 1.69 ERA in August, and it's better than that so far in September. And he had a 22 Ks and only 7 bases on balls in August. So generally speaking, because of Gausman coming from the Orioles system and having good stuff, I figured he was going to get compared to Jake Arrieta on the trade market, but it doesn't appear that Atlanta gave up a ton to get him. So what do you think about Kevin Gausman, both this recent hot stretch, and how excited will you be about Kevin Gausman going forward as a starter in the National League in Atlanta?
I think Kevin Gausman this year, if he continues to do what he's doing, is going to be a guy that wins people leagues this year because of when they got him and that they would have paid nothing to get him at that point. Looking at him next year, I think of him as a glob guy because there's still a lot of uncertainty, right? Like, Atlanta's the best place for anyone to pitch. But I think that division is getting a little bit softer, so it's not kind of weighs itself out by where he'll be playing some of his road games. So, yeah, I think of him as a glove guy moving forward. A guy that I'll take at the right price, but I don't know yet if it's somebody that I'm going to be targeting in drafts.
Well, my guts tell me that the Arrieta comparison is going to be hot and heavy this offseason, because of this incredible hot streak that Gausman has had since his change of scenery from Baltimore to Atlanta. I think you're going to see people justifying Gausman as a top 25 to 30 pitcher next year, which sounds like you're not in on whatsoever, Andrew. Is that right?
No, yeah, that's right. Not even a little bit in on.
Well, I strongly believe that you're going to see that, and some of that theory comes from the fact that we saw guys like Ross Stripling go in the top 25 of the three-sport draft. We'll know more after the early mocks, which I know I signed up for. Did you get your invite to the two early mock drafts?
I did, and I signed up immediately.
Yeah, I did as well. So we'll have some really early mock drafts that will give us a bit of a hint as to how hot and heavy the industry is going to be on Kevin Gausman. I mean, he's always had strikeout potential, and he's seemingly always had that turn the corner potential, as much as Glasnow, if maybe not a little bit more. But he had a longer stretch as a starter where he was struggling, where you couldn't rely on him, than even Glasnow had. So it's going to be another very curious case. Like I said, I'll be stunned if his ADP next year doesn't have him around the 25th pitcher off the board or better. And so the price will be sky high going forward. Just like if you're in a league right now that allows trading, Kevin Gausman's trade value has definitely spiked a tremendous amount because he really has had nothing but stellar starts since he's been an Atlanta Brave. Let's talk about one more guy who's completely different because he's on the other end of the spectrum. Let's talk about Andrew McCutchen. This is an interesting case because we have a guy in Andrew McCutchen who has basically never played before in a hitter-friendly environment for his home park because he was a longtime Pirate, considered the face of the franchise, won his MVP there. Then this past year, he has moved to San Francisco and played in a very difficult park to hit in and has not been all that productive. So we'll get this small sample size of him as a Yankee in the heat of a pennant drive and perhaps in some playoff games. And then we'll have to figure out exactly what to think of Andrew McCutchen going forward. Are you excited? Will you be excited to own Andrew McCutchen next year if he lands in a hitter-friendly environment?
I don't really know. So, I mean, I haven't gone and looked at where the potential landing spots could be for Andrew McCutchen. I wonder how much he's actually going to play for the Yankees, which isn't I mean, doesn't sound like they gave up a whole lot for him. They gave up a couple pitchers and they're paying half his salary, but like essentially once Aaron Judge returns, like McCutchen doesn't have a place to play, right? So it'll be interesting to see, right? It's another guy like at the right cost. Like if you're getting him in the back half, back third of drafts next year, I think it's worth rolling the dice on. Just because I don't think it's unforeseeable to think of McCutchen as like a 15-10 guy next year. Gets in the right environment, maybe he can be a 20-10 guy. Well, he's almost 15-15 right now, so he could be 20-15. Like, I think that's still not off the table for McCutchen. He's going to be 32 next year, still walks at a good rate, so right fit. I think McCutchen's still an effective player, and if he is drafted as that guy, I'll probably be out. But if he falls in drafts, I think I'll have some interest. Be a nice, probably fourth or fifth outfielder for him.
Well, this is where change of scenery runs into name value, right? Like, yeah. It's sort of a nice thing. It's sort of comforting to own a player who's had the history that Andrew McCutchen does. And you can look at Andrew McCutchen and say, oh, he's only 32 years old, but the decline has been a little steeper than you'd expect for an athletic player of his ilk going into, you know, his age 33 season next year. So I think he may have a little more value via that name value than his actual performance warrants. I think there'll be a lot of concerns about his batting average, a lot of concerns about, you know, dwindling power and sort of him of hitting the age cliff completely going into next year, which some of that criticism might be unwarranted. Maybe people will be a little too hasty to judge him considering he has not had much benefit when it comes to home parks during his career. That's for sure. And at least him still getting up into double-digit steals shows that he still runs fairly well. I mean, bat speed will be another thing that you'll probably hear people trying to gather any information they can about this offseason to see how much his bat speed has slowed down. So to see if he's just getting dominated by power pitchers or not, there's a couple different angles to look at it from. The other interesting thing is, if he were to really catch fire as a Yankee, you know, there's a $12 million option, I believe, on the table for Brett Gardner next year. And I think the Yankees have given up the thought that they're going to get any value out of Jacoby Ellsbury going forward, which would be hard to blame them for at this point. So, I mean, they would still have Clint Frazier, but it seems like there's still the possibility that he could fit in the Yankees' plans next year if he were to really catch fire. And so in places where you can pick him up for nothing and stash him on the bench and perhaps keep him next year, I think that is at least worth the thought of entertaining. He's much more a traditional Yankee type, though, than he is a new Yankee type. Like, traditionally, the Yankees were very into established veterans, and obviously they've curtailed that a great deal in recent years when they decided they were going to go with the Gary Sanchez types, as well as some of their outfielders, and look around their infielders now gets you to you know, Miguel Andujar and Gleyber Torres, who are very young style players pretty quickly. I know I assumed maybe that the Yankees would go back to their ways a little bit faster than they have as far as filling in spots with veterans, but they stayed under the luxury tax so far this year, and so we'll know a lot more about them going forward by spring training next year. You agree with that as a Yankees outlook, Andrew?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of that's going to come down to, like, it's going to come down to McCutchen and how much he wants to play next year. Because I think if he sees himself as a full-time starter, that he should be a full-time starter, then I don't think he's going to be all that interested in staying with the Yankees. But otherwise, yeah, I agree. It's definitely something that the Yankees used to do, where they'd go get a guy like McCutchen for the name value and the guy you can put out there and say, yeah, we rah-rah, like this is, look at this great signing we have. And I think they're going to get back there again. I think it's just part of the cycle where you start with, you know, you got to build your team from your internal core. And then they'll start adding, you know, a few years down the road, you'll see them start adding like big name veteran guys as they approach their 30s to try to keep that core alive and well and contending.
Well, another subplot that I thought of when I put Andrew McCutchen on this list is the fact that we tend to think of athletic young players as almost always aging gracefully. And both Jacoby Ellsbury and Andrew McCutchen go against that. Another guy that always comes to mind for me, because I'm obviously a bit older, is Andrew Jones. Was a guy that was a Gold Glove center fielder for the first 4 or 5 years of his career in his early 20s, and was playing in Japan by the time he was in his early 30s. I think it's been overgeneralized, and I do think that McCutchen is going to be an interesting case study going forward, and somebody I'm going to point to regularly. Because when he signed that contract in Pittsburgh, everyone pointed to the fact that he was the type of build that ages well. And I think we are going to be less and less reliant upon that. I think people have a tendency to overlook players who seem to be very athletic that just don't hold up well. You know, Kevin Kiermaier. I mean, how many years in a row have we thought of Kevin Kiermaier as a breakout candidate, and he just doesn't get on the field enough for that to actually matter? But it's not like he's overweight. It's not like he's swinging for the fences every single time he's up there. So a lot of these ideologies that have grown over time, these mantras that we use within the scouting universe, seem to be challenged to me more so than people usually think. Do you agree with that assessment, Andrew?
Yeah. I mean, there's two sides to every coin, right? The great thing about athletic players is, like, the Kevin Kiermaier type is that, you know, it's always the sky's the limit. You know, maybe this guy can be 20-20 or 30-20 or some combination of those numbers. But at the same time, guys that run often and run really well are more susceptible to Achilles injuries and like hamstring injuries and all those types of things, because their body is in use simply just more often. And it's not always about being like your favorite example right now, I think, is Josh Donaldson. Like, take a look at Josh Donaldson. Does he look like a guy whose legs never work? Because he's a guy whose legs don't work right now. And they haven't worked in a considerable period of time. And the Blue Jays haven't been forthcoming with what the injury was. They just kept calling it, you know, thigh and hand or like calf soreness, which, but like clearly that's not the problem, right? He's not like, he's not, I can't imagine that he's dehydrated or he's malnourished. So, I mean, players break down and they break down at different rates. So, I think it's something we have to keep in mind, and we also have to remember that it's not in every organization's best interest to lay it on the table for the public as to what the actual injury is that somebody's going through.
I think you could also extend this out to the fact that when people draft their teams for fantasy baseball, they have these sort of these ideals in their head of what they want baseball players on their team to look like, what kind of players they are. You know, some people really like the Tommy Pham's and the Byron Buxton's and the Kevin Kiermaier's and the Kevin Pillar's. And it's nice because those guys will all offer you some speed because they are quick players. But it also puts them in extra danger into the kind of plays that they make on the field itself. You know, Kevin Kiermaier is always going to be a guy who's running into walls and jumping over walls, and so is Tommy Pham, and so is Kevin Pillar. And you can build a team that's filled with those athletic types. Josh Donaldson was very, very athletic and very much put his body second when it comes to making any sort of plays along the rail or in the field. And those guys don't necessarily hold up as well as you might think over time. Not everyone's going to age as gracefully as, say, Torrey Hunter, who's a guy who, you know, from the not too distant past who was like that as well. Or you could build a team that's full of softball players, which is you know, my sort of fun way of looking at, you know, guys like Nelson Cruz and guys that are big lumbering guys that are going to take less chances in the field to hurt themselves, but don't have a body that looks like it's going to hold up as well as it has in a number of these cases. Edwin Encarnacion, remember, it's hard for us to even fathom him as a third baseman at this point. And he didn't even start his career until, you know, he didn't really get a jump start on his career until later in the aging curve to begin with. So there's just a number of these type of players around, and you can sort of formulate your team however you want. I have a tendency to want a mixture of both, the sort of lumbering, bat-wielding, offensive-minded players with a group of players that are more carefree with what they do in the field, but also better on the bases. I know your theory last year, Andrew, was to load up on speed as early as you could get it, basically. Has that changed with the results that have happened this year, or do you feel like that's what it's going to be going forward yet?
I don't think I was necessarily wrong in that strategy. I just got some of the wrong guys. I mean, Donaldson really hurt me. Corey Seager really hurt me. Essentially, those two alone just squashed any chance I had of winning with that team. But the thing I do see changing is not so much, I think I would maintain the same strategy in the sense that I wanted a lot of balance. What I think is going to change moving forward is I'm going to try to get more power early, and that's just because there has been a shift in what's happened with home runs this year. I mean, Chris Davis just became the first one to hit 40. Home runs are actually down across the board, while at the same time players are still striking out just as much, so it looks like maybe the old baseball has come back. So I just think there's going to be a huge premium placed on guys like J.D. Martinez and Giancarlo Stanton, Aaron Judge, those guys that can hit 40 plus home runs. Chris Davis as well should continue to be highly valued, and I think even more valuable next year as we see the overall arc of home runs get suppressed. Whereas this year, the general thought going into the year was you can pretty much find home runs anywhere. So like my thought was, if I can get a bunch of 2010, 2020 guys, that I would still get enough home runs, and I'd have enough steals, and it just hasn't. I was just wrong on the power, and part of that was because guys I was leaning on for 50 to 60 home runs just found their way to my bench because they're on the disabled list for the entire year.
Yeah, I mean, we often think about pitchers having a learning curve when their stuff diminishes. We think about that to a large extent. We've thought of that over the years. You know, that Justin Verlander had to learn how to be a pitcher after he was very successful being a thrower who could also pitch a little for a number of years. What we don't usually look at that maybe we should is that players have to learn to play within themselves as they get older in the field as well, and maybe running the bases. You know, look at a guy like Ben Zobrist, who has stayed relevant well into his middle 30s. He's not a guy that we think of as making diving plays or, you know, trying to extend plays on the bases like a younger player would. And, you know, becoming at one with the aging process is something that both players and pitchers need to deal with over time. And I don't think we've focused much on how players have to do that to some extent. There's very few Torrey Hunters of the world that can be diving over fences and stuff even their last year in Major League Baseball. That's an oddity. Usually you have to learn to make the plays you can make and not dive all over the field as you get older, because you want to stay on the field and your body needs to be treated differently than it does when you're in your early to mid 20s. So I think that's a subplot of what's happening there as well. So anyway, I wanted to look at some players that we knew were going to have changes of scenery. Either they've gone to a team they're going to be with for a while, like Pham, or they've, and Gausman for that matter, or players that we know are not only changing scenery as of right now, sort of within the last few weeks of when we speak, but will also be changing scenery again. So, you know, that adds an extra twist into what their value is going to be going forward, what their potential keeper value is this year, and such. Andrew, are you working on anything special now? How close are you to, have you got all your hockey stuff set for the fantasy hockey branch of FWFB? What's going on with you with your work? And spout out your Twitter handle again, please.
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at Andrew K. Dewhurst. Working through lots of fantasy hockey stuff. Starting up an analyst league this year because there wasn't one that I was even aware of. So I'm getting one going for that, as well as, you know, getting regular season hockey starts in about 30 days. So still got to get all my team previews out there and get the podcast going. But be plenty of work to do, and it's just a matter of finding the time to do it.
Yeah, I mean, as listeners out there, you probably know this is a harder time to find baseball content. A lot of the roto leagues around are sort of wrapped up, or you have people who are out of contention in those leagues, so listenership dwindles a little towards the end of the baseball season, especially once the football podcasts really start rolling out, which they've been rolling out now. There's not really much of a football off season either for podcasting anymore. But football podcasts really hit high gear going through this past weekend when most of the drafts are finally done and the football season is nearly upon us. So we're one of the few places that we're still trying to put out as much content as we can. And it's going to be interesting because I just got done with my three-sport league and I'm sort of trying to find people to talk to me about the draft and what we can learn about the draft numbers from the three-sport league as far as football and basketball are concerned. But this time of year offers up challenges for even finding people with extra time because of the football blitz that's going on right now. So anyway, I can be reached at Just Chucking It on Twitter. I thought this was another sort of off the beaten path thing that we could look at to end the season, because like I said, these change of scenery players are coming into focus both for the stretch drive of this year and both for the start of us analyzing where we're going to be on potential players we can draft next season as well. This is Chuck Anderson and Andrew K. Dewhurst signing off for an FWFB Concept podcast. Thank you for the support.